Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. I want to make sure to mention that a friend and colleague, and also someone who's been a guest on the show a couple of times, Mike Rinder, has unfortunately passed away. He fought a battle with cancer for quite some time and was valiant and was able to start a whole new life once he left Scientology, even though he had to leave his other one behind, including a son who he was not able to continue having a relationship with once he left. And it is incredible to see what can happen and how people can change and how their lives can change once they get out of a group like Scientology. I remember years and years ago, if anyone heard my conversations with Mike Rinder, they would have heard us telling these stories where, as a spokesperson for Scientology, he was also taught to be aggressive and to be in your face and to harass. And I remember him trying to intimidate me and getting in the faces of clients of mine who had come to speak about their experiences in Scientology, sometimes for the first time at a conference. But as we had a chance to talk about it years later, he really did believe that he was, as they were telling him in Scientology, saving the planet somehow by doing what he was doing. I remember when he contacted me, and we were on Skype at the time. He was starting his show with Leah Remini and wanted to be able to talk to me about how to approach helping people tell their stories in a way that wouldn't re-traumatize them, which was a really lovely transition that I got to see in him, that now with leaving Scientology, he was able to act with certain sensibilities about not wanting to cause trauma in others. But when I first saw his face on my screen, I jumped back a bit. And he said, "Oh, I get that a lot." And so he is someone who knew that he really had a whole former existence as someone who was really an attack dog for Scientology. And now he was trying to do really good work. He started a whole new life and got married and had two boys who are growing up now without a father, but with being able to really know that their father became a hero. And that's wonderful for all of them to know. It's unfortunate that he's gone. It's also unfortunate that Scientology continued to harass him, even knowing that he had stage 4 cancer, because they just didn't care about that. And so a lot of the people came together who loved him, who were there really trying to protect him too from these attacks. But eventually he succumbed to cancer, and we will miss him and we'll miss the work that he did. And we know that it will live on. I hope that 2025 proves to be a year of health and healing. I know that the new year can be a challenging time where we look back and we look forward, and just know that we will be here each week with new stories, with people sharing their story of being victimized, but also finding a way to find their freedom and get the support that they need. And so I look forward to being able to bring you more and more episodes this year as it continues on. And for today, we have Andrea Dunlop. She is an author and podcaster with 2 decades of experience in book publishing, and her books have been featured in major publications such as In Style, Us Weekly, Vanity Fair, and People Magazine. In addition to her writing and consulting, Andrea is the host and creator of the popular true crime investigative podcast about Munchausen by proxy. It's called Nobody Should Believe Me. Andrea is further examining Munchausen by proxy in her new book, The Mother Next Door, Medicine, Deception, and Munchausen by Proxy, a narrative nonfiction title to be released in 2025 from St. Martin's Press. She is a member of the American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children's Munchausen by Proxy Committee and is the founder of Munchausen Support, which is dedicated to providing resources for frontline professionals, families, and survivors dealing with Munchausen by proxy. And just by way of explaining, this is a new topic for us to be covering here, and there will be yet another episode about this subject coming afterwards. It is an important subject because it dovetails so much of what we talk about. It dovetails the ideas of deception and people taking advantage of their power over somebody else, really making someone their victim so that they can feel powerful, they can get their own needs met. It is an illness, and it's something, unfortunately, that children suffer through at the hands of the adults who put them through this. But it's something, as you'll hear Andrea talking about, that actually really is one that has themes that are woven into so many of the themes that we talk about in cults, where there is this sort of influence and power that someone has that comes from an illness, that comes from a sick place. And a person who they are supposed to be protecting and taking care of is someone they harm, just like within cultic groups. For more information about Andrea and to find out about her work, you can go to www.andreadunlop.net. Here is Andrea now. I am so happy to have Andrea Dunlop with me on the show today. It is so interesting to go into uncharted territory for this podcast, but to see that there are so many similarities, there's so much crossover, just as, you know, when a guest comes on and has a story to tell that's not about a Bible-based cult or something else. Of course, I look into it, but also having a background in psychology, I knew about this diagnosis and I thought, yes, absolutely yes. So it's really nice to have you on and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I love talking to people who are in, you know, the professions like yours and the healing professions. Yeah, there is so much crossover. I mean, for me, when I first saw in the literature about Munchausen by proxy, which is what we're talking about, the cult connection, that was such a light bulb for me. So I'm very happy to be here.
Good. Yeah. And, you know, because my background is in education as well as psychology, there were times I was thinking back before talking to you today and times in just my experience of teaching, where I had parents who were very committed for a variety of psychological reasons to having their children get diagnosed and be evaluated over and over and over again. But it takes it to a whole other level when you enter into the medical model and, you know, people have to endure things, not just sitting and taking yet another battery of tests that are written tests, but any kind of physical testing or diagnoses or medications, etc. I think it's also interesting that you got interested in this because of a family member. And a lot of people will
say, well, will come to me and say, you know, I was traumatized by something and it didn't happen to me directly, but it happened to someone I cared about or at the hands of someone I love. And it makes such a huge impact to the degree that you are now devoting so much time and effort to educating people about this. And so if you can give a description about what Munchausen by proxy is and why it's called that, and then we can start talking about your story and what you've learned, how it ties in with cult manipulation and coercion.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Rachel, it's funny because just there you hit on something that is a big point that my colleagues and I are talking a lot about, which is, you know, the definitions and how to really settle on a definition and a way of thinking about this abuse that really encompasses what it is. And specifically, that really is true to what we're hearing from survivors. You know, I think that that's part of my work that I'm so excited about. You know, along with my committee colleagues, I'm on the Munchausen by Proxy Committee that's part of the American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children, which is like a big multidisciplinary organization. And then I'm also the founder of an organization called Munchausen Support. We're the only nonprofit that's dedicated to this abuse specifically. And I have a bunch of my committee colleagues are on there with me. And so we're, you know, one of the things that we do through Munchausen Support is run support groups for survivors, for family members, for, you know, non-offending parents, for grandparents. And we have learned so much from that population of survivors, which has not been studied previously. There is one of my committee colleagues, Dr. Kathy Ayoub from Harvard, is doing a study, a long-term study on survivors, but that data is not published or available yet. And other than that, there really has been no comprehensive effort to study survivors. And so we're getting so much interesting feedback from those, from that population and those folks that have been brave enough to come through with their stories. And, you know, one of the things that we've really come to understand is, although, you know, we can talk about a couple different terms, you know, there is the term medical child abuse, which I think is helpful. And that is tied to Munchausen by proxy, but can happen sort of for other reasons. So that is when you're talking about over-medicalization, right? So parents who are exaggerating, inducing or fabricating illnesses in their child. But that can happen for different reasons. That can happen, you know, most cases that I've seen of medical child abuse have been Munchausen by proxy abuse as well. But it can sometimes happen because parents are suffering from delusions or because, you know, they have postpartum psychosis or something like that. Or just that they're very anxious parents. You know, parents can over-medicalize their children because they're anxious and that is still harmful to the child. So we still want to have an intervention there, but it's a very different intervention than when you're talking about Munchausen by proxy abuse. And so the term that my colleagues and I are using much more now than either medical child abuse or the psychiatric diagnosis, which we can get into, is Munchausen by proxy abuse. Because Munchausen by proxy abuse, yes, there is a focus on medical issues, but it often, in fact, always goes into other realms, right? So you see it in educational abuse, right? You see parents separating their kids from the rest of their classmates. You see them getting diagnoses with sort of ADHD and autism spectrum disorders, and they have to have individual education plans and all those, you know, all that interaction with the teachers that you're talking about. And actually, teachers are incredibly important frontline workers for flagging this abuse because they spend so much time with the children. And if one of these child victims is in school, they are lucky because a lot of times the kids get pulled out of school, they get homeschooled because of their, you know, supposed illnesses. So it really encompasses all of these different things and very, very deep psychological and emotional abuse. And that actually, I think, obviously the medical abuse and the physical pieces of it can be life-threatening. And so those are especially dangerous. And those are the ones that usually end up in court, right? Those are usually induction cases, cases where parents are fabricating symptoms to get their child a surgery, which I think most people don't understand quite how easy that is to do. So those cases obviously can be life-threatening and really require, you know, serious and immediate intervention. But I think in terms of the survivor's experience, you know, that lifelong psychological abuse of being told you're sick when you're not and really disrupting a person's ability to understand their body, understand the symptoms that are having in their body, you know, and really also just the betrayal of discovering that a parent has done this to you, you know, all of those things I think are really what stick with people long after. Certainly the physical stuff can be very serious. And, you know, you talk to people who are still suffering physical symptoms from their abuse. That's pretty common. But, really the psychological pieces are just so, so tragic, and they really disrupt a person's ability to live an independent life, to establish relationships with other people, to trust other people, to trust themselves. So I think we really want to talk about this abuse as it is, which is an all-encompassing dynamic. And it's so obsessive. I think what sort of separates this from other types of abuse, although certainly there is crossover with other types of child abuse, but is the relentlessness of it, because there's really never a break. You know, there's times when the physical pieces can get worse or better, but it really is just every day, like they're living in the world that that parent is creating for them, which is a world where they are sick, they are different from their peers, they will, you know, they're often told they're going to die young, they're, you know, very afraid of what's going to happen to them. So we really are sort of using that description more. Yeah, and then we can sort of talk about the psychiatric diagnosis as well, and why that is actually a very difficult piece of this whole abuse, is the misunderstanding about it being a psychiatric diagnosis rather than a form of abuse that can be identified with evidence.
Okay, right. So what's so interesting about what you're saying, yes, the relentlessness of it, that it's going to be par for the course, because it depends upon the parent's ongoing need to get that need met in whatever way they can. And if that is something that they're not having attended to, they're not getting help with, and this is the only way they get help with that need, then right, it's going to be a relentless push for their children to be basically put in harm's way. I was noticing also, going back to my work just doing counseling and teaching, there are times that parents will jump into being part of a community of parents who have children who have X, and that what matters not is if your child has X, but if you then want that community and you want to feel like you are a fellow survivor parent of this. There are kids who I've seen, and again, going to a non-medical model and going to just, a diagnosis, let's say learning disability or some kind of diagnosis, while I do think that all of those are very valid diagnoses and they have a place and people are able to get the services that they need, I just remember two different situations with families where I didn't see, after doing a lot of testing and interviewing, I didn't see what this diagnosis would normally look like and be like in that child. But I could also see that when the conversation went that way, the parent looked so upset that the child would then exaggerate. I could see it happening in the moment. They would exaggerate their symptoms, or if, let's say, they were told that they had attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and they couldn't sit still. There was a poor child who was so tied in with his mother's needs that when I said, I don't see signs of ADHD, which would normally be relieving to a parent, right? The mother looked like she was about to cry. And then the child would start shaking his leg and look like he was restless and he couldn't sit. And I could see that it was the relationship that was sort of also keeping it going, because he needed to tend to her while she was really using him to tend to her as well. So no one was tending to him. And so, you know, I'm sure you've seen situations like that too, because it is in the nature of the relationship. And that's really the difficult part here, among other things.
Yeah, no, you're describing the dynamic exactly. With the caveat there that, like, there's no single situation where you could look at a red flag like that and say definitively what it is. That could be a super anxious parent that has some other mental things going on, and her child is just, you know, children are, you know, I have a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, and they are incredibly attuned to what is going on emotionally with their parent. And they, you know, all they want is your attention when they're little, right? And they're going to naturally do anything that gets you their attention, or, you know, that gets them your attention and your love. And, you know, obviously most parents would never misuse that power. But of course, like, you know, if we're talking about a cult dynamic, there's no easier person to be a cult leader for than your own children, right? They're just naturally like, you already have control over all of the things that a cult leader would take control of an adult person, right? When you talk about like the BITE model, which I can never remember off the top of my head what that stands for, but this behavior, information, technology, emotional, right?
Yes, like, thought.
Oh, thought, yes. And I mean, thought makes more sense than technology. Although technology also you have control over as a parent, which is also like actually information is technology. So, but yeah, I mean, you already control all of those things with your kids, right? And like, that's good, right? Parents should control those things with their kids. You're in charge of teaching them how to behave. You're in charge of the information that gets to them. But you can see how if you were misusing that, for whatever reason, if you were misusing that, that can cause harm to your child. And I think specifically in Munchausen dynamics, the kids are often being told, you have to do these things. You have to either tell the doctor or the teacher or whomever that you have these symptoms, or you have to sort of perform this. Because if you don't, they will not believe you and you will not get the help that you need. And so they're being told that in a way that like they're in on it, but not in on it, because of course they don't understand that it's a lie, but they're being told, they're often being told like really scary things about what will happen to them if people don't believe their mom. And say, oh, these doctors won't believe me if you don't tell them that you're sick, if you don't cough while we're in the office, if you don't have this symptom, then they won't believe me that it's happening. And so then that gets extra confusing for, and often like it's pretty obvious to providers when a kid is sort of performing it. But sometimes to, people who are not practitioners who don't know what they're looking at, they're going to be like, oh, no, I saw that kid have an episode of, whatever neurological condition they supposedly have, or like, I saw that kid acting like that. Like he for sure has that thing. And then the other, extra complicating factor is that sometimes if there's induction in the abuse, if that child's being given medication they shouldn't be given, if they're being overdosed with something, if they're being given something else, then that could cause side effects that then mimic symptoms. And so then other people are observing a kid that is having, X, Y, and Z. So it can all just get extraordinarily complex.
Oh, yeah. And then to add to the mix, not that we have to add anything to this mix already. Okay. But then dealing with kids who I deal with who were told they were evil, that they are possessed, that they need an exorcism because they're being quote unquote willful, or because they're gay or trans. And the parent will kind of propel them forward towards that as a means of help. That's their medication, doing, an exorcism, because I think they really do believe that is what's happening here. So you have sort of the religious overlay in a lot of these situations that I deal with. But I think also that a parent will sometimes get kudos within certain religious environments for noticing that that's what's wrong, and then going to the pastor or to the person doing the exorcism, and they get a lot of kind of religious,
a lot of positive reinforcement.
Yeah.
Well, and it's really interesting that you bring up religion. The case that I'm looking at right now for season 5 involves an evangelical woman who adopted kids from abroad. And so there's a lot of really interesting stuff about the church. And the church actually shows up in quite a lot of cases. And it's very interesting. So I want to say one thing off the top that, like, obviously the dynamics that you're talking about are also abusive, maybe for different reasons, because it sounds like what you're talking about is parents that sincerely hold those beliefs. Doesn't mean those beliefs are any less damaging. Doesn't mean that abuse is any less damaging. With Munchausen by proxy abuse, and we were talking about sort of these other reasons that parents can over-medicalize their kids. With Munchausen by proxy abuse is characterized by intentional deception. And this is why it can get so tricky when you're talking about a psychiatric diagnosis, because there is a DSM diagnosis associated with it. However, it is not something that makes people delusional. They understand right from wrong. They understand what they're doing. And it's executed over a long period of time. So, that deception piece is really important. However, there is a lot of interesting interplay with the church. Number one, because the church can be a tremendous source of fundraising, which happens a lot in these cases, of support, of a place to get attention and a place to get that community, which is the intrinsic reward that perpetrators are looking for, and can also really provide a cover, because it's a community of people that is sort of already sort of primed to a belief system, right? And seeing someone as a part of their community, that's an automatic piece of trust. And I mean, all of those things about the church can also be very good, right? I mean, I never want to just imply that that's a negative thing out the gate. I mean, you see a lot of churches that are very interwoven in their community, that provide a lot of support to their community, in addition to seeing, you know, some of these horrifying things that we hear about. But I think what's also interesting in our current climate, something that has been very much on my radar since the case that we covered in season three, the Maya Kowalski case in Florida, is the intersection with this and the parents' rights movement. So it's really intersecting with this at the moment because in that case in particular, you know, there's a real tension between, you know, it's manifesting in sort of all areas, right? You've seen this in education with book bans and Don't Say Gay bills and like that kind of thing about like what teachers should be doing in the classroom. And this also crosses over into like what ability the state should have to intervene in a family situation. So, you know, right now, mandatory reporting laws are really under threat because of this Maya Kowalski case. And it's gone to appeal. I'm hoping it gets overturned. If that stands, then it will really throw mandatory reporting laws into disarray. And right now we have a situation where medical professionals are, you know, protected. They are required by federal law to report a reasonable suspicion of abuse. So they can be in big trouble if they don't. And there are cases where medical professionals have gotten in trouble for not reporting abuse, especially when it ended with a child death, such as the Olivia Gant case in Colorado, which was a Munchausen case, where the doctors did not report, and then the child was released to her parents' care, put on hospice, and she died there. You know, right now, they're in a bit of an impossible situation because they are supposed to be protected from litigation. You're not supposed to be able to go litigate against a doctor that reports in good faith, right? There's a whole separate thing of, like, an actual false report, but a false report would be someone doing it on purpose, right? Like someone out of genuine spite and there's no evidence for abuse. So it's pretty easy to tell those apart from, you know, I get asked all the time about like false accusations of Munchausen. The only ones I've ever heard that really are like false accusations is sometimes it comes up in like a high conflict custody battle and like a, you know, father will say, oh, well, she takes the kid to the doctor too much. I think she has Munchausen by proxy. But like, that's the only person saying it. None of the doctors think that's what's going on. None of the teachers. It's like, it's very, very clear that's a false accusation. But, you know, really how it's playing out in that lawsuit and several other situations around the country, like in Pennsylvania, there's a like class action lawsuit. In California, there's a lawsuit against Rowdy Children's in San Diego, is that there are many people, and it's sort of the quiet part that they don't necessarily say out loud, that they don't really believe the state should be able to intervene if a child's being abused. They want parents to be able to take their children to the doctor and the doctors fix them up and they send them home. And there is a massive attack on child abuse pediatricians right now in this country and in the media. And unfortunately, I'm about the only person I can think of that is trying to counter this narrative with, you know, data, facts, evidence, that kind of thing. You know, that these doctors are just looking for abuse and they're out to get parents. And it's just not, I mean, the data shows the opposite. Actually, child abuse pediatricians are less likely to find abuse than other doctors because they're more highly trained, right? So they're not going to go on assumptions about how a parent seems, you know, with their child or their socioeconomic status or those other kind of things that can lead to parents ending up in the system that don't belong there. And so actually, if you are a parent who is innocent, who is bringing your child in with an injury that might look suspicious, right? That like has some of those red flags. Like red flags are not a diagnosis. Like red flags are not evidence. There are some situations where an investigation needs to happen. And like, I was talking to Dr. Jill Glick from University of Chicago, who's a child abuse pediatrician there. And she was saying, you know, in order to sort of protect everyone, you know, we have like, there's certain types of injuries in children. I think it was under two in that case. That like every time a child comes in with one of those injuries, we're going to look into it, right? And we're just going to, you know, we're going to get the child abuse pediatrician in there. We're going to do, you know, not like a full-on CPS investigation, but like we're going to look into it every time one of those types of injury to just also sort of like remove those biases, right? So it's like, okay, if this is like the child of someone that like, you know, is a fundraiser for the hospital or whatever, same as like a parent, a family that came off the street and we don't know them. Like we're just going to treat all of these the same because it's so common, you know, these injuries are so common. So I think like a lot of, I would suspect a lot of children's hospitals have those kind of policies. And I think that like, I've even had friends that have taken their kids in because they had a certain kind of injury and they're like, yeah, we had to talk to a social worker. And like, yeah, of course, because we brought our kid in. It is usually like pretty easily cleared up. So if you're a parent that's bringing your child into the hospital with one of those kinds of injuries, or something that looks suspicious for, you know, if there's something that looks suspicious for Munchausen that is a red flag that turns out not to be, you want a child abuse pediatrician. You are less likely to end up with a wrongful suspicion, or you're less likely to end up with some full investigation or getting separated from your kid. You're less likely to end up with those bad outcomes if you have a child abuse pediatrician. And this makes perfect sense when you think about it for a moment, because child abuse pediatricians, they're a recognized subspecialty, right? There's boards, there's the whole thing, there's a whole process. And, you know, there's a relatively new subspecialty. It's only been around since the 90s, you know, but this is a recognized and robust subspecialty. So it's like, you know, if you had breast cancer, would you want just a general doctor on that breast cancer? Or would you want an oncologist that specializes in breast cancer? Like, it's so obvious. And I really, Dr. Jill Glick said this thing to me that has just stuck in my head, where she said, child abuse medicine is not a belief system. You know, it's science. And so, you know, it's real medicine. And so that is the sort of tension. And that is very much intersecting with, and obviously not all religious people are, you know, parents' rights people, but this, you know, this sort of extreme faction that we're talking about, where you see these other movements to really, really just take the sort of influence of the public sector out of family life and out of parenting, is a big cultural move backwards that we are really seeing kind of come to a head in many, many ways. And I think that's really influencing the conversation around this form of abuse in particular.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's interesting. I'm now remembering, too, a case that I had years ago where, for a while, I don't think they're doing it anymore, at least I hope not. There's a family where the parents were divorced. The father was a Jehovah's Witness and was trying to get custody of his kids, full custody. And the way that he was being encouraged by the Jehovah's Witness location that he went to was to convince his son and daughter that they were being abused by the other parent, so that the son, who was now 9 or something, was going to be encouraged if he saw certain signs. Like, the father defined what abuse is, and it wasn't. It's not that. But it was things that you would just normally see in a household environment. So there was this gaslighting piece, this intentional deception of redefining what something looks like so that he would for sure see it, because it's a regular daily thing in a family and not unhealthy. And that if he saw those things, he needed to call the Department of Children's Services. And so his 2-year-old sister and he were taken out of the home. And then they finally, they did meet with a doctor who evaluated the children and said everything was really fine. And not only did they evaluate the children physically, but they noticed the interactions between the parents and the children. And in fact, there was more worrisome behavior between the father and the children, which I don't think people would necessarily have been careful about really notating, because kids will often let on about who the culprit is here and who's the one who's really scaring them.
Right, because kids don't know. Kids are more transparent than adults because they just don't have all of those sort of extra levels of ability, you know, to hide things set up. And I think it's, you know, and it gets really complicated, right? And people who do like forensic interviews of children, I mean, we'll talk about it. Like, it's, you know, it's very, very common for children to defend their parents, to defend even abusive parents. And sometimes, in fact, you know, the abusive parents can be even more enmeshed with the children than the other parent. It's just unbelievably complex. You know, and in medical child abuse cases, Munchausen by proxy cases, you know, when they end up in court, when they end up in trial, they often get very, very fixated on some, like, one thing, like one piece of evidence. Like, you know, a very common misconception is, oh, well, if this child, you know, like in the Maya Kowalski case, an example. So she, you know, her parents claimed that she had this rare neurological condition called CRPS, complex regional pain syndrome. I'm very confident in saying that she did not, because I looked into the origin of this diagnosis and it was very clearly fabricated by her mother. She talked to another, you know, parent on a message board. You were talking about these communities of parents of kids that have these things. And she said, go to Dr. Kirkpatrick in Florida. He'll give you the diagnosis. She reported to another doctor that this child had the diagnosis before she ever received it. She'd been told by 3 other world-class hospitals that she did not have this diagnosis. So fairly comfortable saying that this was fabricated. And, you know, in the trial, you know, which this was the surviving parent suing the hospital. And then, you know, but even sort of the whole case became about, does Maya have CRPS or does she not? And that's the wrong way to look at it, because it could be both. She, you know, just because a child has CRPS does not mean that you go wildly out of the, you know, medical treatment standard that, as you know, sort of standard of care, as this family did, and take her to, you know, Mexico and put her in a coma for 5 days and being giving her these just like absolutely horrific doses of ketamine, giving her ketamine at home. Like, even if she had CRPS, that would still be abuse. So we get very fixated on these little things. We're like, was it this thing? Was it that thing? What, you know, okay, there's video evidence of this abuse, but like, what did it exactly show? And so you get very fixated on these narrow things and just completely miss the forest for the trees. And again, looking at this as like, this is an abuse dynamic. And so you're also, you know, part of it is the medical piece. Part of it is the evidence, the record review, you know, of like, there's often like tens of thousands of pages of medical records that need to be looked through for those inconsistencies and looking for that evidence of intentional deception. But it's also, you know, like when there are police investigations, when there are good police investigations in these cases, which there often are not, you know, and CPS investigations, they're talking to teachers, they're talking to friends and family and, you know, other people who are around the children. Like, this mom is saying this child, I mean, it's something that comes up all the time. This child that, you know, this mom is saying this child is having seizures every single day. Has anyone else in that child's life ever seen a seizure? And like, you'll go around and everyone will be like, no. And they'll be like, well, there was like one day where she was staring off into space and her mom said she was having a seizure, but like, I don't know. And it's just like, it just doesn't match up. And so I think it really, like, we have to look at it holistically. And I think, again, there's like a real tension on whether or not people think this is just something we should do at all, right? Like, it's sort of this question I'm finding is really coming more and more to the fore because of a whole bunch of political issues of like, are children the property of their parents, or are they human beings with their own human rights? And are they a project of the community? And I very much obviously think the latter. And I think, you know, as a parent with a child that just started school, I have a kindergartner, you know, you really start to see that. You really start to see like, okay, now I'm sending my child out of the house and I am trusting them with like adults that I don't know that well, you know, I've just met. And it's like, it is like, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm just like sending my baby out into the world, you know? And I think that there's a lot of like, you know, and especially with like some of the rhetoric about all these things, there's a lot of fear there, right? And we all want to protect our kids. And so I think like I want to make room for the fact that there are some legitimate fears. And then unfortunately, like the media, you know, especially the way they cover Munchausen by proxy cases and with this whole narrative around, quote, medical kidnapping, which is a conspiracy theory. There's no evidence that doctors are incentivized to separate families from children. It makes absolutely no sense. It's a gigantic, it takes a gigantic amount of resources. They put themselves in legal jeopardy, reputational jeopardy. They end up being the villain of a Netflix film like Dr. Sally Smith after working for decades to protect children for, you know, not very much money. Also, like, would like to debunk the idea that like child abuse pediatricians are raking in the cash. It's one of the lowest paid subspecialties there is. And one of the hardest. I mean, I can't imagine doing one of these doctors' jobs for a single day. Like, the things they see are just horrific. They see the worst of humanity day in, day out. So medical kidnapping is a conspiracy theory. Unfortunately, is getting blown up by NBC News. Mike Hixenbaugh did an entire series on all these medical kidnapping cases. I've looked into a bunch of these. All you need to do is read one of the police reports in these cases, because some of them have to do with Munchausen by proxy. Some of them do not. He covered my sister's case, for example. But, you know, there was these others about abusive head trauma and like broken bones and stuff like that. And you read the police reports and it's just like, as a reasonable person, you're like, well, this parent's story doesn't make any sense. Like, this, none of this makes sense. There are wrongful accusations of abuse. Parents do end up in the system when they shouldn't be. Those things happen. However, those people, once they get their children back, are relieved. And they just want to move on with their lives. Those are not the people who wage lawsuits. And those are not the people. Now, are there exceptions to this rule? I'm sure there are. I have yet to find one. The parents that go and seek media attention and do the lawsuits and what, I mean, that is like those cases, when I have looked into them, do not look like false accusations of anything. And so I think, you know, there's a lot that's making parents afraid. And I've heard from so many people, especially about the specific cases I've covered. Like, I covered my sister's case and covered the Kowalski case. And I've heard from people in those areas that are parents and said, oh my God, like, I take my kid to this hospital. This is the hospital in my area. And I was so afraid to take them because I saw this news report. And I'm so glad I know that this. I'm like, That's a horrible thing to do to parents, especially parents of sick kids. It's like instilling fear in parents of chronically ill children that they cannot trust the doctors because the doctors are going to snatch their child away. That's a horrible thing to put in people's heads, you know? And it's not true. I mean, there is no evidence. And that's why when you see these stories, they're just anecdotes, and they're anecdotes told in a very specific way. So you see, it's like there's a real anatomy of these stories, right? So you take a parent who's saying they were falsely accused and they've been through the court system. And, you know, unfortunately, we're not very good at handling abuse in this country. Most children who are abused end up getting returned to their parents. That's the most likely outcome. There is an emphasis on reunification. I think that is, and there are other problems with disproportionality. This review talk about like neglect cases and things that have much more to do with, you know, parents struggling with poverty or struggling with mental health issues that they should really get help for, or that parent just needs some more support or some more resources. There are plenty of those parents. That actually accounts for the majority of parents that end up in the system, are those sort of neglect cases, which can be a lot of other things other than like a person being a bad or not capable parent. And then of the people who end up in the system for abuse, you know, most of those kids are sent back. So, you know, these stories that end up in the media, like in Mike Hicks and Bugs, which I've looked into a bunch of his cases, you know, and they're set up as like, oh, doctors disagreed. And they're saying doctors, they don't mean treating physicians. They mean the treating physician said it was abuse. The child abuse pediatrician said it was abuse. And then the doctor's defense lawyers hired expert doctors to come and testify that it was not. And there are like a very, you know, there's this group of doctors that shows up in every one of these cases. One is a doctor that doesn't believe abusive head trauma is real. One is a doctor, is like a radiologist from California who has no experience in pediatrics, who will come in and say anything was just a, you know, this type of fracture is not abuse. So it's like presenting those in the media as doctors disagree, like, oh, doctors disagree that it was abuse. It's like, well, listen, I think everyone deserves to have representation in court. I don't think there's anything wrong on its face with like having, you know, an expert come and testify for you, but that can be just so misleading. I think it confuses things in court. And certainly by the time it sort of gets through to the media, you're just like, oh, well, this parent was falsely accused. This sounds like a real, you know, this sounds like a real problem. And it's just so paper thin when you actually look at the facts on the ground in any way.
Right. And I want to be able to hear about your sister's case as much as you would like and feel comfortable talking about it. I guess what I wanted also to get into is the psychology of it and what drives it and the gender differential as well. And I'm now remembering, it's so interesting talking to you, I'm remembering a situation with a mother who I was working with, who was bringing her daughter to one doctor after the other. And after, I won't get into the whole story, but really it's sort of at the end of the story is the fact that she dealt with what a lot of women deal with, that she had real symptoms and real issues when she was growing up and was not believed. And she had endometriosis and she had so much pain all the time. And everyone kept saying it was in her head. And so when her daughter became of age to get her period, she just said it was like she was in a trance. Like she just started taking this daughter to one doctor after the other, almost by virtue of like association, that if her daughter was validated as having an issue, she would finally be validated through that sort of connective tissue, you know? And that's a real thing that women are not believed.
Oh, 100%. And you just hit on one of the sort of, you know, I think I probably could not have picked a more complicated issue to dedicate myself to because it has overlap with like really the most fraught systems in our country, you know, like the medical system, which is just a morass of all kinds of things. And then, you know, the child protection system, the legal system, like all of these things, one of those is so super complicated. This crosses all of them. So, you know, one of the things that is very real and that we really try and be aware of is that because this is, as you said, this is mostly women, and I can get into my thoughts on why that gender differential exists, 96% women perpetrators of this abuse. But, you know, obviously the women and, you know, all you have to do is be a woman and you understand this, right? Like, I don't know a single woman, including myself, who has not had a bad experience with the medical system from sort of like ranging from just kind of that like ambient misogyny to, you know, getting a misdiagnosis or having something missed or being having your pain underplayed or like, you know, if you've ever had an IUD inserted, like, I mean, just like the fact that that was sort of like, there was no recognition that that was something that might need anesthesia, even though it can be extraordinarily painful for some people going through childbirth. I mean, it's like you could sit here and name a thousand things. And of course, there's the medical system has a horrible history with women. Didn't include women in clinical trials until the 1990s. Didn't even study, you know, female cadavers until the 1970s. And then obviously, like, there's incredible tension then on top of that with how women's bodies have been politicized and the, you know, lack of access to now reproductive health care. And just like, it could not be a more fraught time between women and the healthcare system. Those things are very real. Medical misogyny is very real. Women's pain is not taken seriously. It is dismissed. Women's accounts of their own experience are dismissed. All of these things are very real. And the situation that you're talking about, I mean, that really breaks my heart. And I could see that could happen, right? And so I always do want to emphasize that, like, there are other situations. Now, there's some harm still being done to that child. And so that is something that, again, needs an intervention, a very different intervention than an abuse dynamic, right? You can see how, like, we're so protective of our children. And I think especially, like, you know, I have a daughter and a son. There are these sort of like visceral fears I have for my daughter. And I could see that really kicking in if that had been. And that's a horrible experience. Like, you know, you talk to people with endometriosis, that's extremely common. I mean, I think that's the norm that it doesn't get diagnosed and it gets dismissed. And it just says, oh, you're just having period pain or whatever. And so, I mean, yeah, that's like a very valid fear. So there are sometimes when, like, you know, or if you talk about like parents of color having to advocate for their children, that they have to advocate to the point of exaggerating and sometimes probably even of fabricating, right? So that it will be taken seriously because they're not taken seriously. So like there are ways where, you know, those things could sort of like look like red flags. They're not going to look like abuse once you scratch the surface. And people know the difference, you know?
Exactly. Like if you have fabrication as a necessary adaptation to get your child what they need, because otherwise you can't, then you're just learning the system as flawed as it is, right?
Yeah, you're reacting to the system. And so again, I want to emphasize, if what you want is a system where parents are not being wrongly accused of abuse, you want child abuse pediatricians. Child abuse pediatricians are the most knowledgeable. They are the least likely to jump to conclusions and to understand all of those nuances because they have just spent so much time with the system and they spend more time interacting with social services and like those kind of things where they're aware, way more aware than your average physician of those problems, of those disproportionalities. Like they're just a lot more attuned to those things. So like if you are a parent who is worried about those things, if you are worried about those things just on a societal level of like people being mistreated within the medical system, you want a child abuse pediatrician. And also, like, I mean, in my just this is in my sort of like anecdotal experience, but like a lot of child abuse pediatricians are women. And I don't think female doctors are perfect in this respect, but like, I think they are. I think a lot of women are more comfortable seeing female doctors because we're less likely to just get this sort of ambient old man misogyny that can happen with older male doctors, right? Or younger male doctors, not excluding them. But yeah, to sort of get to your question about this is a psychiatric diagnosis and kind of some of that piece. So again, as I said, there is a diagnosis that is associated with this abuse, factitious disorder imposed on another. What a mouthful. That is the official DSM-5 diagnosis. And that is just the sort of psychiatric, psychological explanation for why a person would do this abuse and I would perpetrate this abuse. I think it's helpful in our understanding of the why, because I think it's such a horrifying behavior that people do get very stuck on the why because it's so the opposite of what most parents would ever do. You know, you were talking even about some of your experiences of like, even with something like ADHD, or which is like a pretty common diagnosis. I have a friend that has two boys and they just went through that whole rigmarole of tests. And I think there's like there's an interesting nuance there because I think she was like, she was feeling down about it. It was a stressful experience. I mean, her boys are brilliant and they're wonderful kids, you know, but she was having some feelings about it. And I think also she was sort of relieved to have a diagnosis and have a plan. And like, so I think there is that piece where people are like, all right, we finally got to the bottom of this. But like, you know, as you were saying, that most parents would be relieved to know that their children didn't have, you know, especially something that not like ADHD, but something like a childhood cancer or leukemia or CF, you know, cystic fibrosis or something. Most parents would be incredibly relieved that their child does not have this very serious diagnosis. And you see the opposite in these parents, right? They are driving towards it. They are fabricating it. They will not accept no for an answer. You know, they continue to go. And it's not, again, it's like very, when we talk about doctor shopping in these cases, which is going to see all these multiple healthcare providers, it is not the same pattern as a parent who's legitimately trying to get a diagnosis where they're like going to a parent, you know, because you said like that can happen, especially with women, especially with, you know, I think even younger female patients, like that someone could be like, oh, it's just period pain. Oh, it's just that. And they're like, no, it's really not. It's not what I'm seeing. That pattern, once you're in the medical records, which they always look at the medical records in these cases, looks so different than in an abuse case. In an abuse case, it's something like, oh, your child does not have cystic fibrosis. Okay, you go get them retested. And then they're, you know, interfering with the test until it does show that they have cystic fibrosis. Or you're going to a doctor and they have a blood test for something. And it says, oh, this does not, you do not have, you're not positive for this thing. And then the next doctor they go into, they say the child is positive for that thing. So again, intentional deception. You know, what I always say about, I've started to say like more and more about these cases is because we talk about, you know, oh, these cases are so complicated. They're complicated in the level that there is a lot going on. And certainly they are complicated to present in court because judges don't know what they're looking at. The system is not set up to catch abuse. So they are complicated to prosecute. They are not complicated to see. This is one of those things where once you see it, you cannot unsee it. And I am having this conversation with you. I've had like five other conversations. It's like, I talked to so many people where they're like, you know, I listened to your show and I thought about this person I know or this patient of mine or this, you know, like teachers and people who work at schools and stuff. It's like everyone can think of suddenly a case that they know. So number one, that speaks to like there is, and there are some studies about the, you know, not very many. It's very hard to get funding for studies about Munchausen by proxy because it's hard to get people to accept that it's even real, even in sort of the scholarly community or something that needs attention. But it's often described in the media, almost always described in the media when outside of my show, that it's extremely rare. It's not. None of the experts that I've spoken to believe that. There was a good study in the GI department from Seattle Children's about sort of the prevalence versus abusive head trauma. And it was like 2/3 as common as abusive head trauma. Abusive head trauma is the most common form of child abuse. So that certainly speaks to that. And then just anecdotally, the number of people I talk to, the number of messages we get from people in the show, I'm like, it's not rare. Like there's just no way that it is so vanishingly rare, because if it's something that was rare, I wouldn't just be talking to people about it all the time. Like, you know, and I really think that anybody who is working in a frontline profession with kids, if you are a teacher, if you are, you know, an OT or PT that works with kids, if you are a doctor that works with kids, like you are going to see at least one case throughout the course of your career. So it's something that I think everyone needs to be aware of. But to get back to like this question about the psychiatric thing and how that plays in. So psychiatric diagnosis, someone who engages in these behaviors of, you know, again, fabricating, exaggerating, or inducing illness in their child or someone that they're caring for, right? This can happen between with vulnerable adults as well. So that does also fit the model. Sometimes you see healthcare professionals that are abusing children in this way. The Lucy Letby case in the UK, where she killed a bunch of, it's a horrible case where she killed a bunch of babies, you know, is a Munchausen by proxy dynamic. But mostly it's mothers of small children. And so the psychiatric diagnosis has to do with the reason why. So there is a lot of times a lot of fraudulent fundraising in these cases. There's a separate diagnosis that's malingering, which is where someone fakes these kinds of things specifically for the purposes of, you know, financial gain or getting off work or some other sort of tangible reward. So while there is that in these cases often as well, the primary reward is an intrinsic one. So emotional gratification, sympathy, support. And then separately, you know, the psychiatrists that are experts on this, you know, really feel that there's like a sort of thrill for fooling people, right? That's part of the intrinsic reward as well. So then those folks will do it in the absence of any financial reward, any tangible gain. And so I think it's really important to understand like the sort of like what is going on with someone that does this, and also like how compulsive it is. I mean, you will see like there are no consequences that will deter a person from doing this. And you see them just continue, you know, they may sort of back off for a while if there's a lot of eyes on them, but like this behavior does not stop. If you send kids back into a house, they will continue to be abused. They might change their methods. They might move on to a younger child, but it will not stop. And certainly then once their kids come of age, they often turn it on an older parent or a partner or back on themselves or some combination of those things. So these are some of the most, and I think people really have a hard time with this, especially because it is women. These are some of the most dangerous people that you could be around. And I think like that's something that's very hard for people to grasp. So I do think it's interesting to talk about and helpful for people to understand what's going on from a psychology level. With that said, the psychiatric diagnosis itself has caused a lot of problems. And the Kowalski case, which I'm actually presenting on next week at a psychiatry and law conference, is a perfect example. You know, and you often hear, right, oh, this person hasn't been diagnosed with FDIA, so they couldn't be participating in this behavior. It's just not the right way to think about it. First of all, a lot of times in these cases, they'll bring in a psychological evaluator to sit down with the alleged perpetrator, and they'll sit, like this happened in the Kowalski case, the defense hired this person. So they, you know, had a psychological evaluator sit down with Beata Kowalski, and she said this report, and she said, oh, there's no evidence of this person having Munchausen by proxy or having factitious disorder imposed on another. That's not something that a psychological evaluator can determine, especially not within the course of like one meeting, because this is a form of abuse for which there is evidence, a lot of evidence. And that evidence lives in the person's social media, in the medical record review, in the interviews with friends and family, in the doctors, in the medical records. It's not something you can just sit with a person and be like, yeah, this person has, you know, FDIA. Is not the show signs of having FDIA. No, you can sort of determine some other things that might make them more vulnerable, right? Like, oh, this person has borderline traits, which is really common, comorbidity, or this person has, you know, narcissistic traits. But you're not going to be able to say whether a person has it or not. So first of all, that. And then, you know, in that, I mean, that trial was completely bananas because the judge allowed the plaintiff to talk about Munchausen by proxy and how Beata didn't have it. And then when the defense's turn came up, he said, Munchausen by proxy is no longer relevant to this case. And so you cannot mention it now. And so they were not allowed to present all of the evidence that this abuse was taking place. So it got framed as a psychiatric diagnosis. And like Gregory Anderson, who's the lead attorney in that case, was like quizzing doctors on their knowledge of the DSM-5. I mean, it was so preposterous. So I think that it really causes as much trouble as anything right now and sort of allows for defense teams. And I've also heard of cases where people have used it as a defense the way that you would use, you know, something that is sort of like an insanity defense, right? Of like, oh, well, this person, you know, doesn't deserve to go to prison because they have this condition. Well, no, like it's not something that reduces criminal culpability. They know what they're doing. And yeah, and again, it being such a compulsive behavior, it's not something that should ever like lessen a sentence. And I don't mean that because I feel like, you know, I'm not a person that like really, I have some pretty mixed feelings about the criminal justice system, as I think many of us do. I'm not someone who's really big into like throw people in jail in a punitive measure, but I think insofar, like for the system we have now, insofar as jail is a measure to like protect a community from someone, I do think these offenders belong in prison because I don't know what else. I wish there was something else that we had to do with them. I wish there was another system, you know, system where like folks could be kept safe and not that. But like, I mean, with what we have now, like I don't really see a good other option.
Right. Feeling the need to separate them out from the people they can harm or put in harm's way, yes, makes a lot of sense. I think also when I look at things psychologically, I try to think about how to get under it, how to help someone from the inside to see if you can lessen their need to do this. And understanding it psychologically is, I think, the only way to really do that. Although that is something that might have success or not, or might not have success in time to save someone else's life. So I could see why that is problematic, but I still see certainly the value in that if it's possible. And I'm wondering to talk about the case that you dealt with personally that brought you into caring so deeply about this. If you can talk about it for a few moments, that would be great.
So my older sister, Megan Carter, is a perpetrator. She has never been held accountable despite the efforts of many, many people. There have been two investigations into her for Munchausen by proxy abuse, medical child abuse. One with her older child, which I was present for that situation. That was almost 14 years ago now. And that led to my family becoming estranged from her. And so that was a very sad situation in my life. That was when I learned what this abuse was. We really went through that as a family completely alone. It was quite traumatic. I was close to my sister growing up. She's less than 2 years older than me. Our relationship had become increasingly strained by the time that investigation happened because of sort of a long series of behaviors like this. And I go into all of that in detail on the show. And then she was investigated again for her younger child, much more sort of severe and life-threatening situation in that case, where her daughter almost died. I think her daughter probably would have. I think there was a good chance her daughter would not have survived. It was not for the interventions of the doctors in that case. What they got for as a thanks for that was being trashed in the media and sued by her, or she attempted to sue them anyway. The lawsuit was dismissed. Yeah, so really an awful situation. That's what has brought me to this field. And I'm happy to say that I have been able to connect with so many other people that have been through cases. And it is very healing and rewarding for me to know that like other families do not have to go through this alone anymore. And it's not, I want to say it's not just me. It's my colleagues from the committee, my colleagues from Munchausen Support, my wonderful mentor, B. Yorker, is now the president of Munchausen Support. I don't have to do anything with the day-to-day on that. So I am still on the board, but, has really been instrumental in the survivor support groups and everything like that there. And so there is now a community around it, which is really so incredible. And we have some amazing dads that have, non-offending parents that have gotten involved there. And we're speaking at conferences. People are going in front of the legislature in Texas. Like there's a really, small but mighty group of people who really, really care about this. It's not where I thought my life would end. but I am, I am really trying to do something useful with it. And certainly like, I think, in terms of just as a sort of content creator or storyteller around it, I mean, these stories are certainly fascinating, complex. And I just, as a sort of person in the true crime space, I really feel strongly about bringing the focus to victims and survivors and families and really humanizing this. I think when it's covered in the media, it is covered very sensationally. You see sort of like the Gypsy Rose Blanchard story and these other stories. And usually when it's covered in the news at all, if it is, there's a really big focus on all of the medical piece and this kid had this many surgeries and this many doctor's appointments and sort of like all of this stuff. And it really just is like sort of the tip of the iceberg. And so I'm just very interested in humanizing it. And that includes humanizing the perpetrators. I think that like, something that is really powerful to me, and I think that I'm equipped to do because the perpetrator in my life is necessarily humanized. That's my sister. I know her as a human being, before it really got this far. And I will say that like, I interviewed my parents for my upcoming season, which was very moving. And I did not think they'd ever do that. They did bravely talk about their experiences. And I realize that these behaviors go back a long way. But with that said, I do know her as a human being and care about her still. And it's not helpful to look at perpetrators or anybody who does, something horrible as a monster. I think that that is something that we kind of default to and that especially entertainment defaults to and sort of true crime. And there's a lot of irresponsible true crime. It's not helpful because it hides the abuse from we are hiding the abuse from ourselves when we do that. Because, I was talking to a colleague who's a child abuse pediatrician. We were talking about the sort of medical kidnapping narrative. And I sort of thought like, this doesn't make any, it's like, if you scratch the surface even a little bit, if you really ask someone like a couple of questions about it, you're like, do you really think doctors are like incentivized to snatch children? Like, why would a doctor? Well, and it just like, doesn't make any sense. And yet it's so clickbaity. It's so, people like do believe it. So I'm like, what's the draw here? And he said something that really stuck with me. And he said, people don't want to believe that child abuse can be perpetrated by people who seem normal because that makes a much scarier world. It's a scary world when you have to think that like someone who just seems like a nice, normal parent, especially in these cases, they seem like a loving parent. They seem like a parent that would go to the ends of the earth for their children. It's not just a normal parent. Like they really are playing up the sort of savior thing of like, oh my God, this mom who's been raising, whose kid has cancer and is such a sympathetic figure and she's so loving and she quit her job to take care of her kid and da da da. To live in the world where that's possible is so terrifying. And it's terrifying on like a visceral level that people would just rather believe, because I think like, it's almost like I make a lot of analogies to like the satanic panic, right? And I think like part of what was going on in the satanic panic, because you're just like, okay, well, like doctors snatching children from parents for no reason is as preposterous as like daycare providers have underground satanic ties. Like, even on a logistical level, it like sort of doesn't make sense. And yet people believed it, right? And I have a strong theory about what was going on there. That was really around the time that we were starting to grapple with child sex abuse being as pervasive as it is. And the reality about child sex abuse is much scarier than satanic cults, because the reality is that it's most likely to be a father, an uncle, a stepdad, a baseball coach, like someone who is a trusted figure in that child's life. That is the most likely, you know, priest, like that is the most likely figure. And that is so much scarier than satanic cults, because if it's satanic cults, you can just get rid of the satanic cults. And you're like, just look for the underground layers and get rid of, find the Satanists, you know? So like, I think we're having a similar thing here. It's like, it's much easier for people to say like, oh, the child abuse pediatricians are the problem. It makes no sense. But like, you know, the child abuse pediatricians are the problem. Fire them. And then we don't have to worry about it anymore. Rather than like, no, you have to look at like your neighbor, your friend, your sister could be doing this. And that's just a really, and why we called the book The Mother Next Door, right? Like the book that I have upcoming with Detective Mike, because it's like, that's what it is. It's not a person that seems like a monster, and you wouldn't see them, you know, you wouldn't see them coming down the street and think they were like a scary person. Sometimes, I mean, well, they come in all different shades, right? Some of them seem very off-putting, and like Brittany Phillips, one of the perpetrators we talked about in the case, and like, she was a person that did not have a lot of like social polish. So, you know, people were like, yeah, something's up there. They didn't necessarily know, oh, this is Munchausen by proxy, but they're like, this does not seem right. Like the whole dynamic seemed off. And she's very like mean to her child in front of other people. And so sometimes they're like that, but a lot of times they're not. A lot of times they are like my sister, who seems charming and lovely. And like, if you met her, you'd just be like, what a nice, smart lady. She's sort of positioning herself, and she's now working for the public defender's office on medical child abuse cases as an expert in medical forensics. And like, she's positioned herself as a champion for people who have been falsely accused of medical child abuse, as she says that she has. So, you know, it's not someone that would like necessarily rate. I think most people who are around her for a long time, you know, as the people have reported to me and people have kind of gotten in touch, the podcast has been out, like most people catch on that something is very wrong after a while. But it's just a much scarier world to live in. But that is the world that we live in. And I can say that because this all happened to me when I was in my late 20s. So I had a lot of life where I wasn't exposed to anything especially scary. I had a very nice childhood, you know, and that's also was like one of the things people ask about a lot is like, okay, is this behavior connected to childhood trauma? Not that we know of. Sometimes, but, you know, and I think that there are some strong connections between childhood trauma and abuse, period, right? Like people are more likely, so the ACE scores and like, you know, people are more likely to become perpetrators of abuse if they were abused as children. But in terms of the specifics of this abuse, there are families where there are some reports of abuse. Of course, it can be very difficult to get to the bottom of it if a perpetrator who's a pathological liar is saying it. But with that said, you know, there are some families where like, okay, there seems like there was likely something going on here. But just as many, and most that I've heard of, no known history of abuse. So certainly not in my family. Hope Ybarra, who we covered on the case, Mary Welch, like these are people that have no known history of abuse. So, you know, I had a very nice life and a very loving parents and a nice, like upper middle class childhood and really everything you could possibly ask for in life. So I had a very, you know, I had a life where I didn't have to live with any sort of scary specters of this going on. And then I sort of had to cross this bridge and live in a new world. And it does feel like you sort of, it is one of those moments, the revelation of this abuse happening with someone that you're close with, you like remember where you were. And you're like, oh, my life was like different then all of a sudden. And I sort of it's done something strange to my own memory. Like I look back at the person I was before this and I'm kind of like, I don't really like, I feel a like disconnect with that girl. You know, I'm kind of like, oh, that was my other life. Like I just sort of like, you know, I'm like, I'm really not the same person. And it really has, you know, there's a period of my life where I was really recovering from that situation. And I had some real mental health issues, as you can imagine, for a couple of years after that, and really just like needed to get my life back on track. You know, and then there's this other period of my life where I really decided like, okay, I want to like, I'm ready and feeling healthy enough to like go and try and do something for someone else with this. And that's, you know, it is difficult work, but it's very rewarding.
I'm sure it's very rewarding. It can feel, I'm sure, at times also like pushing a boulder uphill.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
You know, when I first started in this field, it was around the time of the Satanic Panic. It was the McMartin trial time. It was the repressed memory, Courage to Heal time. It was all of it. The amount of times that I heard the word pentagram, right, in one day alone, the calls that I was getting, especially being a cult specialist, well, I'm in a satanic cult, or that's what's happening underground under my house. And I think you're right, you know, looking at what's happening for real, like what can happen in people's psyches that then can in some ways disconnect them from other people's pain and the other people being people who you want them to be feeling protective over, not have the ability to hurt or to endanger. That is a scarier image. That's very real, and that's hard to grapple with. And it's also true when you talk about your childhood that everyone has a different childhood, no matter, right, if they were in the same family. And so I usually don't ask all siblings together, how was your childhood? Because it's as though they all had different parents.
Absolutely. It's such a good point. And, you know, I mean, this is something I've spent and my parents have spent so much time thinking about with Megan. You know, that was my experience of my childhood. You know, neither my parents nor I can think of any like incident, right? Like there was no like thing that came out about like a family member, a coach or anything like that we know of, right? I mean, that doesn't mean it didn't happen. That we don't know. That just isn't anything that we know of. And I also recognize that like, and I think one of the things that makes me so sad is that I recognize, especially with some of these behaviors that go back really to like Megan being a kid or Megan being a teenager, which is the teenage stuff is stuff I remember. My parents remember stuff from when she was a kid, that like she was in pain for a long time. And I think that this thing of like not being able to get what you need emotionally without deception, without causing a crisis, is really sad. I mean, it's really destructive and causes a lot of pain to a lot of other people. And I think especially like once you get down the line where you're like putting a child's life in danger, obviously very hard to sort of like sympathize with that. But I think like, especially when I think about her when she was younger and some of these like, you know, earlier incidents, it's just really sad. And they are, you know, from what we know about these perpetrators, I mean, they often suffer from major depressive disorder. They're not happy people. And it's really sad. And I think you can hold that empathy for the human being that is experiencing those things while still recognizing the harm that they are doing. And I think for me, I want my niece and nephew to be safe. I do not feel there's any chance they will ever be safe with her. I think there are behaviors, and it's like, we seem to have reasonably just like agreed on this society that like for child sex abuse, like, you know, if you perpetrate child sex abuse, I'm like, you don't get to be around children anymore. Right? That's why you have like registries and you can't be near a school. And like, and I think we should look at this abuse the same way. You know, like it's not that we should, you know, throw those people off a cliff or like that they don't deserve treatment or they don't deserve compassion or they don't deserve, you know, efforts to like try and, you know, but I think if you've done this to a child, if it is this specific behavior, right? Like not if you did it because you were having delusions or anxiety or like those other things are just totally other cases. If this is a legitimate case of Munchausen by proxy abuse, you are not a person who is a safe person with children, period. You should not have children in the home. You should not be around other people's children. You should not be in a job where you're caring for children or people, really. Like, you know, we've heard stories about people going on and being like at-home caregivers and bad things happening to people they're taking care of. You know, so I think you should not be around children or vulnerable adults, like, period, end of sentence, because you're not safe. And it's such a compulsive behavior. The patterns are so strong. There's just no way, even if that person is seeking therapy, like there's just no way to guarantee that a child would be safe. And we have to prioritize the safety of children. And like, with that said, I hope one of the places we can get to is recognizing this behavior so much earlier that an intervention could be more effective. Difficult to treat regardless, even if you're talking about like a teenager with Munchausen behaviors, which is when you do these same things to yourself. You know, that happened to my sister. That was true with Hope Ybarra. That's true. Not every single perpetrator has Munchausen behaviors that precede Munchausen by proxy behaviors, but it's very common. And certainly there's always a history of like deception, that pathological lying, like those sort of maladaptive coping mechanisms to get your needs met, like that kind of thing. So it's like, if we get interventions on those things, I do think that that could, my hope is that that could really be preventative for this abuse happening in the first place. Because I think like with child abuse, you know, we should always be looking at prevention. We should always be like, what factors can we control before this, before harm is done to the child? Because harm is done to the child. And like, I think sometimes people, you know, will sort of look at me and think like, well, I don't know, this is a terribly good faith criticism, but like, you know, people will be like, well, there's just like, she's sort of like I'm somehow out to get parents. And like, I'm really not. And I don't want parents, like, it's not, like, there's a tremendous amount of harm done to the perpetrator as well in an abuse dynamic, right? Like, that is horrible for everyone. You know, I don't think that Munchausen by proxy perpetrators, especially those that end up, you know, in induction cases with the poisoning, the suffocating, like those kind of things, I don't think they're capable of empathy. Because I just don't think you could have empathy and do that to anyone, let alone your own child. Like, so I think we have to recognize like what we're dealing with and really be like, again, not hide it from ourselves. I say in the book and, you know, in the end of our introduction, I say like what we're asking, I'm paraphrasing myself here, so I remember it off the top of my head. You know, it's like, what we know, we're asking you to look at something hard and we're asking you not to look away. And that's sort of my ethos with the show, right? Of just like, don't look away. Like we have to recognize this. This is in our communities. And like when we look away, the children are not protected. And I think really like, you know, we're in an extraordinarily divisive time politically, but I really think that most people do care about children and do care about their welfare. Maybe very different ideas about how that should be executed. But one of the most encouraging things about this show is that we have the show and sort of the community around it. They're like a pretty wide tent, you know, like the second season, the show that there was a Republican sheriff who I adore. And like, that was not on my bingo card for this little period of time. And, you know, there's a tremendous amount of trust between me and that family. And we've had a lot of that on the show, right? We've had just like people from all different stripes politically coming on and saying, you know, like, and we're very aligned on what we think about this abuse and sort of how it should be handled. And so I think like, that sort of gives me hope in a broader sense of like, you know, I think it's like in those situations where people can remember that their neighbors are human beings and people are sometimes vulnerable to conspiracy theories. A lot of that going on right now, a lot of that going on again in my community with the medical kidnapping stuff. But I think like, I really think that when we really process things differently when we're hearing a human story than when we're hearing like an issue, someone talking about an issue, like really puts us in a different brain. And I think if you're just like listening to someone, you know, listening to like a dad crying about what happened to his kids and being vulnerable, it's like it just resonates on a totally different level.
Absolutely right. You know, and I think really looking at these things is important. You know, as difficult as it is, it's hard. People sometimes will say to me, I can't believe that, you know, I'm kind of roaming the earth with people who don't have a conscience, who don't feel other people's pain, who don't care about it. And it, yes, it is a smaller percentage of the population, which is good. So that, you know, it's good in terms of safety overall. But, you know, on the off chance here and there that I've had a chance to sort of meet a cult leader, there is this chilling impact that they have on you because you realize you're dealing with someone who is so different at their core. I mean, I think about how as I had, like, I became a parent and then had second and then third child, my purse got heavier and heavier. And I realized that what was happening was I had the tissues and the lozenges and the Band-Aid and the Neosporin or whatever, that just in case things, if anything happened, right? And it could be someone else's kid too. Like, there was something in my nature that just made me get a larger purse because I had
mom things. Purse. It's real.
The mom purse, right. It's so real. It's so real.
Yeah, snacks, you know, like,
right? A little bag of Cheerios. Right. Oh, totally right. A little thing of water just in case, whatever. But to meet that, then to come across, like, to know that that's your natural proclivity. And then for other people, they don't have it. And what does that mean? And what are they capable of? And you hope that there is this internal locus of control that stops people. But when you see that it's not there, you, of course, I get bothered by it. I should look at it probably in a more sociological way and just find it interesting. But it affects me.
But no, but I mean, it is disturbing. And I think it's like, you sort of have to process the disturbing part before you can get anywhere. Because if you get stuck on it like that, then and if you don't sort of push past that and kind of just like give yourself that grace to be like, yeah, I'm freaked out by this. Like, then I think you're not really totally reckoning with it. Right. And I think you're pointing to exactly like what, you know, like the mom purse is like a great metaphor for many things. Like it's carrying the sort of emotional weight of the family on your shoulder. Sorry, if you'll permit me like a cheesy moment there. But yeah, I mean, like, and I think it is like one of the reasons specific to this abuse that makes it so disturbing. It's like, I think we've grappled with the fact that like men can be abusive because you can't really go through a woman, like life as a woman safely without recognizing that men can be abusive because we are like, you know, you're intrinsically not afraid of men like all the time, but like in certain situations, right? Parking garages, hello, like sort of like you have to like, you sort of, it's sort of built in, right? But I think to be scared of women and to be scared of mothers, which that is just, it's the most sort of sacred archetype that we have. And it's sort of the most cherished institution that we have. And I mean, and again, could not be fraught more fraught right now with everything going on in the country. But yeah, I think it's like, it's really like, it's so anathema to the way that we think of motherhood. And that is why perpetrators can so effectively weaponize it.
Oh, that's really fascinating. I could talk to you about this for hours and hours. And there's so many different directions to take this in and so much overlap and just, it's incredible. It's so good that you're doing this work. I'm sure it's so frustrating. Also, when you feel like you're the lone voice, it's very hard. And I'm so glad some voices are joining you now. And that I'm sure feels very validating. And then you can delegate out. It's not all on your shoulders, right? The mom birth idea. What can people do to help with this cause, to find out more? Where can they find your show and different kind of legal representation for this if they're dealing with it? So let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, I do have a book coming out next year from St. Martin's Press. It's a co-authored it with Detective Mike Weber, who has been a big contributor to the show, and really meeting him was, I met him at a child abuse conference when I met all of these people, Dr. Mark Feldman and Bjorker and all these people I now work with. I met them at a child abuse conference 5 years ago at the APSAC colloquium. And I'm actually going to do the Munchausen training. I'm going to be one of the leaders of that training in next year. And that's going to be a nice full circle moment for me because that's where I met everybody. Yeah, so Detective Mike Weber and I have a book coming out called The Mother Next Door, Medicine, Deception, and Munchausen by Proxy. And that we are talking about three cases, which we have covered to varying degrees on the show, but much more in depth. And really just like to sort of talking about Mike's incredible career as a detective. He is the, you know, really the law enforcement expert in the country on this abuse. He wrote the guidelines for the FBI. He's incredibly knowledgeable and has far more convictions on this abuse than anyone else. So he's my co-author on that. We were talking about his career and just really sort of, you know, how this abuse sort of sits in our culture at the moment. And I really, part of the reason we want to talk about three cases rather than focus on one is because the patterns of this abuse are so strong. And I think once people sort of see that again, they can't unsee it. So if you want to pre-order that, that is coming out in February, in early February. And then in terms of the show, Nobody Should Believe Me, you can find that anywhere you listen to podcasts. And we talk about all kinds of cases and other related things in a weekly format. And then we have full documentary style seasons where we do a big deep dive into one case. And then in terms of support and resources, the best place to find that is munchausensupport.com. So we have some quick resources and links and that kind of thing for families, for survivors, for therapists who are treating survivors, for therapists to look out for perpetrators, and also for CPS, for law enforcement, for doctors. So we have some quick resources there. And then you can also contact us there if you need help. And then that will get delegated to the committee. So we have people getting in touch for all kinds of things. We have the support groups are run through Munchausen Support. So if you are someone that is looking for those kind of resources, you can find that there. And then if you're just like, I've discovered that, you know, I have the suspicion about, we hear about this a lot, like I have a suspicion that something in my life is, or someone who's involved in the court case, you know, against their former spouse, or if, you know, we hear from a lot of grandparents, stepmoms, like that kind of thing. Just, you know, I'm afraid this is happening in my life and I need help, that you can get in touch with us and we will do our very best to connect you with resources. And yeah, I mean, I'm I'm the only voice on this in the media at the moment, but certainly like I have tremendous support from that community, and that community is really growing all the time. You know, people hear on the show about it and get involved and, you know, come and really like join the club. It's a weird club to be a part of. We all got here usually by something pretty tragic, but it's so good to have community around these things, and it's been really helpful. So that's where you can find all the things. And then just for more about me, AndreaDunlop.net is where you can find about my other books that are not about Munchausen by proxy and that kind of thing.
Oh, that's wonderful. And we'll put a lot of that in the show notes so people can have those resources at their fingertips, which is so, so important. Thank you so much for all that you're doing and for coming on and explaining something so interesting and complicated and disturbing and personal. I mean, having to sort of put all of that together in this sort of cohesive way. I don't know how you did all that. That is quite intense.
I talk about it a lot. I just talk for a living now. So.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha. Well, thank you so much, Rachel. And we would love to have you on the show at some point to talk about cults, because that is certainly something that comes up a lot. And I think that comparison is very helpful and interesting to our listeners.
Oh, absolutely. Just let me know when. I'm happy to jump on anytime.
Awesome.
Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you too.
One more thing before you go. Oh my goodness. Andrea, thank you. Thank you for your work. And also to everyone listening, I know I'm well aware that this is a disturbing subject, but it's very important to learn about it, in part because it's an interesting subject psychologically, and also because it really has so much about the deception that we talk about and people getting their needs met through taking over other people. But I think it's also a way for this show to honor the children, some of whom are still children and some who have grown into adulthood, who suffered through this, who also are the family members and loved ones of those who saw this happen within their families, as Andrea is. And sometimes when I think about the subjects for these particular shows, I do think about it as a way to honor those who have suffered in this way. And the way that we talk about today was Munchausen by proxy. That was the avenue where kids were made to suffer, and many out there who are suffering through it now. There are very few people who are addressing this issue, and very few lawmakers and police professionals and others who are addressing this subject. And the ones who have really stuck with this are heroes in this space. And Andrea has had to have this determination and tenacity to keep going with this particular subject and pushing it through and kind of pushing a boulder uphill to get people to care and to hear her. This idea of having this kind of intentional deception is something we know all too well at this show. And also that there is an intrinsic reward that you feel when you are doing this intentional deception and getting away with it, where you can then be the hero in someone else's life. And in order for you to be the hero, they need to be rescued. And if there's nothing wrong with them, then you make sure there suddenly is. And not only that there suddenly is something wrong with them that you can rescue them from and be their protector and be there to help heal them or take care of them, but there is a relentlessness, as Andrea talked about, a relentlessness to it, because people who engage in this behavior are really never done. They continue until they are stopped or until they don't have access to that child anymore. But sometimes then they will switch their attention onto another victim and another victim after that. So they really do need to be watched to make sure that they don't have access anymore to people who they can affect in this way. There is something that we come across in this field which is this whole sort of pseudoscience idea that the more symptoms you have, the more something is working. And that is also going to make this a confusing picture. So you have people within cultic groups who are engaging in pseudoscience, who might be doing it because they really get joy and satisfaction on a very primal level for being the ones to sit during long kind of waiting sessions in a waiting room while their loved one is in surgery or receiving a certain amount of care. And they can be there wringing their hands or kind of pretending to be wringing their hands while others come to their attention and will sit with them and take care of them and see them as this kind of long-suffering caregiver who is willing to sacrifice their time and attention to anything else in their life in order to be there for their loved one, not having any idea that they're the ones who have caused the illness. But it does get confusing when it's done with pseudoscience, especially, meaning there are a lot of people who are pseudoscience practitioners who, and I hate to even use the word science with pseudoscience, it's just quackery, fakery, snake oil kind of medicinal engagement. And what happens there is that a lot of times when there is a certain treatment given to someone that's not verified by any kind of scientific study, a person will start to be symptomatic. And a person who is a pseudoscience practitioner will often say, that's good. The more symptoms a person has, the better. That means, for example, that if they are really symptomatic, that whatever was inside of them is now coming to the outside of them. Like if they break out into a rash or if they start shaking all over, if they have a fever, that somehow, again, that's a good sign that whatever they've been given, whether it's a mantra they need to say or a pill they need to take or an herb that they're supposed to take, that it's quote unquote working because a person has become more symptomatic. That's often not the case. And sometimes, again, under actual medical care or within a hospital setting, it can be that a person might get worse before they get better. But within pseudoscience, it is a way for the practitioner to cover themselves. It's a way for the practitioner to get away with making a person go through taking something that actually is making them symptomatic in a way they weren't before. And it's like a lot of cult groups where they will tell people that if they see someone really having a psychotic break, that that's a good thing. That means that they're getting in touch with this, maybe this being that they've been channeling for thousands of years, and that's what's coming forward. Or the fact that now they're hearing things and seeing things, well, that's a good thing because that means that this kind of belief system is working, but it actually could be the stress put on someone that's causing their intrinsic schizophrenic propensity to actually come to be full blown. And so there's so much about this whole land of murkiness where symptoms are really seen in a way that they shouldn't be by so many people, by pseudoscience practitioners, again, it's a good thing. By people within cults, oh, it's a good thing. By people who are engaging in Munchausen by proxy, it's a good thing. But it's a good thing for them because then they get what they need. They get the attention and focus. They get to be the hero. They get to be the kind of exhausted caregiver. They get the attention that they so badly need. And by so badly need, that's almost kind of understating it. From people who engage in this, that kind of attention is like getting the air that they need in order to keep breathing. It really is a severe, severe disorder, and it needs to be treated And until a person gets the treatment they need, they do need to be kept away from their victim. But what happens is that because there is very little oversight in these situations with knowledgeable people, people might not know that a person's child or the child in their care is being victimized by them. And instead, they might see that child as lucky that they found someone so willing to be so caring and so giving. So much of the work that I do is in that space of really being confused and not knowing what's real. And so when I heard Andrea talking about these cases, I could sense the similarity between them and cult cases so often. It's like within certain groups, certain church groups, where people start to have psychosis, and instead they're told they need an exorcism because it's the devil inside of them. There are a lot of people who are misdiagnosed. And now with people like Andrea and others who are bringing this to light, hopefully there will be more clarity out there about what we're looking at. What's really happening here, and who the victim is. And again, it's not the exhausted person taking care of the one who's sick, but it's the one who's been made to be sick. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.